Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and I'm the host of the podcast titled Revolution Z. One of the things that we have to do in order to continue is to ask for help. So if you could take a moment, perhaps when the episode is finished, to go to www.patreon.com/revolutionz. There you can find out a little bit more about this podcast, and also, if you decide that you want to, you can give us a little help by becoming a patron. I thank you in advance. Having completed 20 episodes of Revolution Z, it seems appropriate to ask, what do we have and what does it matter? We have one episode about the 2020 election and about electoral work and electoral activism's logic more generally, which will be followed by more election episodes over the course of the ongoing campaign and voting. If you agree with what the election episode indicates, very nice. If not, we have something to perhaps debate or explore if you post a comment or send an email to sysop@zmag.org. That's sysop@zmag.org. That's me. We also have 5 episodes on social strategy to be followed by more. The 5 so far address relating to reforms and avoiding reformism, growing movement size and various factors of gain and loss of support, and some ideas bearing on program related to the economic vision we have discussed so far. Again, if it is all congenial to you, that's very nice. But if not, perhaps we have some things to debate or explore. In any event, future strategy episodes will try to provide additional reports, ideas, examples, debates, and anything else that can help clarify what to do and how to do it to win a new world. Indeed, the next strategy episode will be an open letter to DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, discussing just such things. Finally, we also have 14 episodes emphasizing economic vision, and soon we will add further vision episodes focused on other equally important facets of social life, polity, kinship, culture, and community, and some narrow areas as well, like education, health, sports, journalism, and art. But unlike the sequences addressing elections and strategy, the vision sequence has reached a natural intermediate assessment point. Unlike elections and strategy, that is, the vision sequence, though certainly far from complete, has at least completed one component by at least partly addressing all the key aspects of a proposed economic vision that some call participatory economics and some call participatory socialism. So while the partial answer to the what now question in our title for this episode is more election, more strategy, and more vision episodes, and perhaps a new sequence or two as well, I had something different in mind in asking what now. I had in mind what now regarding the economic vision. What might you potentially do with that vision, having perhaps heard 14 episodes about it? I take this question very seriously. Why else would I be doing Revolution Z? In fact, I think we now have a fourth sequence of episodes in Revolution Z, the What Now sequence, which is why this episode is titled What Now 1, Seize the Time. Seize the Time was a slogan many of us would intermittently use back when I was first radicalized in the 1960s. So how does someone, hearing 14 episodes about a new economic vision, seize the time? That is my question for this episode. Right off, there is, of course, no single correct answer. How to seize the time regarding the offered vision depends on how one reacts to the vision itself, as well as on one's own personal situation. But first, before getting to what now regarding the economic vision, I would like to make a preliminary point where I think there may be a pretty unanimous what now correct answer. Our vision episodes have emphasized some ethical values and aims: equity, solidarity, diversity, self-management, sustainability, and classlessness, and have used them as touchstones for evaluating the worth of any economy. Does some proposed or existent economy achieve equity, or does it diverge from equity? And if it diverges, how badly? Similarly, does some proposed or existent economy promote solidarity, foster diversity, attain ecological sustainability, and deliver self-management and classlessness, or does it diverge? And if it diverges, how badly? About participatory economy, we have claimed positive answers to all the above evaluative questions. But at the same time, I of course must also grant that not everyone who has listened, or who may soon or even ever listen to the 14 episodes presenting the economic vision, will be convinced. So the answer to what now about the economic vision is a multi-channel affair, as we will come to shortly. First, however, what about what now regarding the use of the above criteria to assess the economy we live under, whether you are in the U.S., like me, or wherever else you may be? regarding this, I think maybe most of you who have already or who will get through these visionary episodes will agree quite a bit. Don't you agree, for example, that capitalism horrendously violates equity? That it produces instead gargantuan wealth and income differences due to rewarding property, output, and power? Hell, nowadays nearly everyone sees that much, and surely we do too. And don't you agree that even old-style market and centrally planned socialism, which we have called coordinatorism, while significantly reducing inequality compared to capitalism, retained way too much inequality to accept? Does anyone really deny that? And don't you agree that market, central planning, and corporate divisions of labor, with or without private owners, obliterate solidarity, pervert diversity, deny self-management, and violate ecology, all to much too great an extent to bear, and in the longer run, perhaps even to survive? Okay, many would dispute parts or all of this last claim, but would you? And don't you agree that the economic system you live under retains class division and class rule? Again, no one doubts this, so surely we don't. I can't know for sure, but I would guess that most people listening to Revolution Z, or even most who will ever listen to it, however large that audience may someday grow, will agree on the above. To not agree, once aware of the reality of our times, would require such great self-delusion that I find it hard to imagine anyone suffering that condition would listen to much of Revolution Z. In fact, I doubt I could use words about current economies with their grotesque waste, obscene poverty, and horrendous hypocrisy and subordination of the many that are extreme enough to cause Revolution Z listeners to say, "No, your assessment is too harsh." Indeed, while not often trumpeted publicly, I suspect you reject existing economic relations as not meeting and even as wildly subverting equity, solidarity, diversity, sustainability, self-management, and classlessness. In fact, I would even bet most people that you know would agree on that. In fact, I think in a calm, safe setting, most would laugh at the assertion that their economy, by its intrinsic requirements and functions, gives all workers and consumers fair income, causes people to act empathetically to one another, enriches lives by promoting diversity, preserves lives by advancing sustainability, respects lives by delivering self-management, and avoids schism by attaining classlessness. Of course, many will say that to do better is impossible, but they will also admit that none of that is attained by current economies. In other words, we all hate the institutions and social relations that history has bequeathed us. We all know that everything is broken. In fact, I think almost everyone knows everything is broken. So what now regarding that? Here, I think, broadly speaking, there really is ultimately a right and a wrong answer. I hate the process by which every year we are each a year older, and as we get past 50 or 60, and without a doubt 70, we are a year diminished in our physical and often in our mental capacities, and then steadily more diminished, until finally we are gone. I hate that. I would bet dollars to donuts that you hate that too, or will hate it as you endure it. But if I was asked, what now, regarding all that, I could only answer, make the best of it. Aging is part of being here at all. We can't escape it. We can't stop it. We must accept it. We must make peace with it. We must make the best of it. So be it. Now, a great many people answer the question, what now, regarding capitalism the same way. They say capitalism is like aging. There is no point blowing into the wind. There is no point whining. We must make the best of it. So be it. Permit me a brief related digression, if you will. When I was in college in 1965, entering MIT, I joined a fraternity, AE Pi. To make a very long story short, and I promise at the end there is a point made for our current what now question, during the days of their choosing freshmen to invite to join their fraternity during what was called Rush Week, the upper-class AE Pi brothers bugged our freshman rooms and tapped our phone calls. Yes, you heard that right. They secretly listened to the folks they were trying to recruit, talking to each other, or to parents, friends, or even romantic partners. And then the brothers used what they heard to manipulate whoever they wanted to join their fraternity to do so. It was so easy. They would provide whatever we indicated we thought was missing by the words we uttered, seemingly in private, in my case, to my then-girlfriend at Simmons College. So I joined. I made friends. I enjoyed the living conditions and the very real camaraderie. We pledges were welcomed, but also hazed, mainly by being made alone responsible for cleaning the large fraternity house on Friday nights, until the wee-wee hours, in an exaggerated and hassled way that you might envision for an army drill sergeant punishing new recruits. After a few months, I think it was in late February, upper-class brothers told us how they had channeled us, manipulated us during rush week. By then, we were so invested in our situations, in our new friends, in our schoolwork, and whatnot else, that we passively heard the surprising results. We didn't consider that if they had told us days after rush week, it would have caused us to immediately quit, outraged. Instead of quitting, ensconced in our new home, we all rationalized what we heard and got on with our first year. The rationale was interesting and, of course, provided by our upper-class manipulators. They told us that when we arrived, they knew us since they had researched us, which indeed they had, and that they knew MIT's options, so they knew what was good for us better than we in our ignorance could possibly know for ourselves. So they tricked us for our own good. There is much more, but that summer I woke up to the ugliness of the whole thing, even as these were my then friends. So now a sophomore, I went back to Cambridge for my summer spent in my home city, New Rochelle, to attend my sophomore year at one of the foremost educational and research institutions in the world, living in one of the most admired and successful living units on the campus. But I broke the mold, I quit the fraternity. More, during rush week for new freshmen, I sat on a car fender outside the house, and I told the freshmen, looking to see if AEPI was for them, what was really going on. That lasted for maybe 5 minutes. Then there was a brawl on the street. Some of my fraternity brothers were trying to get at me to punch the crap out of me to make me stop. Others of my fraternity brothers, luckily for me in greater numbers, were holding off the first bunch. But don't get the wrong idea. They were not trying to protect me. Rather, they had realized that if I was beaten up, publicity would rage and all hell would break loose for AEPI's future on campus. They were trying to protect AEPI, not me. So I had quit, and it is worth noting, for what it says about the power of wanting to preserve comfortable circumstances, that I was the first who had ever quit due to being outraged at the spying policies. My upper-class brothers, however, didn't want me to leave. I had been picked out as someone they could invest in. Indeed, they had planned for me to become a kind of star for their house, even to the point, unknown to me, of mapping out a multi-year plan by which I would rise to become the president of the whole student body as a senior. So not wanting to lose their star-to-be, something they had invested in, and not wanting the precedent of someone leaving as I was in the process of doing, something that could hurt them, they rented a room in a nearby hotel, called my father, and got him to come to town and have me come to the room to see him. And there, they orchestrated a major pitch to get me to change my mind and stay in AEPI. First, my classmates urged me to stay. Then prominent folks for each older group of brothers did the same in turn. At first, it was, "We love you, don't leave." But before long, the tone began shifting. And eventually, they had graduates of AEPI, their elite, make their ace in the hole pitch. And now comes the key point for our current discussion. They told me they knew that, of course, bugging our rooms and all the rest of what they did was incredibly ugly, but they promised I was going to be the beneficiary, like they had been. Notice, even most of the brothers didn't hear this. It was just the elite of the elite talking, literally the ones already out in the world, climbing corporate ladders, with no top rung too high for them to reach. And they took off the sugar-coated gloves of the earlier entreaties and said to me, "Grow up. This is the world. You can join us and forget about the rest, or you can be a loser." So their answer to what now, knowing as well as they did the vile reality of their ways and of the world, was, "Come join us. You will win even if others must lose. Reap the benefits. Ignore the warts." And these were the folks who typically go on to be what Noam Chomsky once called the masters of the universe. Quite a commentary, don't you think? Indulge me, please, for one more tale from the past. Many years later, I accompanied Chomsky to Venezuela. We went for a number of reasons, but one was to meet the then-president Chavez. So we were at a session for Chomsky and Chavez to talk together in front of some select folks. At first, they traded questions and answers, but quite quickly, surprisingly, Noam began asking more questions. He was talking with the head of state. There were things he wanted to know. So there came a point when Chomsky asked about relations to the U.S. in Chavez's first year in office, and Chavez relayed the following. "Shortly after being elected, he got a message," he told us, "from the U.S. State Department that they wanted to talk. An emissary arrived, and they sat to talk. After some chit-chat, the emissary got down to it. The emissary's message, clearly from on high, was in so many words, 'Play ball with us, don't rock any boats we care about, and we will raise Venezuela's material well-being immeasurably. You will lead South America in all respects, but mess with us and you will pay the price.' And there was the AEPI logic again, on a much larger scale. The evil is in your interest. Abide it and reap the benefits. Cross it and be a loser. Chavez could have said, come on, we both know that means you will enrich me. You will enrich the already wealthy. You will even provide aid that benefits a wide array of managers and professionals. But the poor will remain poor. The illiterate will remain illiterate. The sick will continue to lack care. Our dignity will remain beneath the boots of the North. Chavez could have said all that, and quite rightly, but he had a different reflex. Instead, he said, yes, but what about Guatemala? What about Haiti? What about Paraguay? And the emissary interrupted and said, what do you care? It is not your business. You will be fine. And Chavez threw him out. The emissary and the successful graduates of AEPI had the same message, unsurprisingly, since they were corrupted by the same rot. In a hierarchical world, if you are lucky enough to have a shot at it, get to the top, by hook or by crook. Okay, let's return to our times. You who are listening to this, I would bet you know that capitalism sucks. You know that even coordinatorism sucks. So now what? Option one. If you have the greed and callousness and advantages of birth and circumstance that it takes to be a beneficiary of its manipulations and hierarchies, you can hang on and try to get to the top. You can put the victims far out of sight and out of mind. You can climb a corporate ladder, rise to a State Department pinnacle, and ignore the corpses and broken souls in your wake. Or, failing the big climb, you can find a lower plateau, tell yourself it is the best available, and again, put the rest out of mind, cynically claiming that nothing better is possible. Option two. If you have the empathy and hope that it takes, you can fight for change. Capitalism is not like aging. It is not like gravity. It is a human creation, and humans can change it. At the very least, we can ameliorate its ill effects. At the most, we can replace it. Here is a quote from a recent Noam Chomsky interview. He says, in the final analysis, Chomsky replied to a question about social possibilities, we always have two choices. We can choose to descend into pessimism and apathy, assuming that nothing can be done, and helping to ensure that the worst will happen. Or we can grasp the opportunities that exist, and they do, and pursue them to the extent that we can, thus helping to contribute to a better world. He concluded, not a very hard choice. But here is the thing. In the real world that we actually inhabit, eyeing the possibility of trying for riches, or, more likely, of at most attaining a plateau of modest plenty, or of even settling for sad deprivation, the alternative of pursuing change may not be such an easy choice. You may have kids, you may be younger than that, facing life, burdened with bills, fearful, worried. You may have endured years or even decades of schooling and upbringing that denied that you have potentials, telling you to take what little you can get and ignore the rest. You may even have been born on third base, and you may be hearing about the comfort of the dominant and enticed. There comes a time to choose, cynicism, social climbing, or activism. But not so fast. There is another problem. Many will feel, okay, I get the moral argument. I understand what Chomsky is saying. But I don't just worry about feeding or schooling or enriching my kids, as the cases may be. Or I don't just worry about squandering my chance, however slight it may be, to win the social sweepstakes by climbing above those who lose. Additionally, I don't see how my being active matters worth a damn. I don't see that there is a better future to win. And even if there is a potential better future, I don't see an actual path to follow that gets there. Okay, in my view, that is fair enough. Indeed, it is what I am trying to address with Revolution Z by offering vision of a better future to win and offering strategy to perhaps illuminate a path to win it, or to at least help inform our finding such a path. So having reached the point of having presented one aspect of full vision, the economic aspect, what now regarding that? Reaction 1. You think it is balderdash and unfixable. You move on with depressed cynicism or with cynical social climbing. Reaction 2. You want there to be an economic alternative, and participatory economics or participatory socialism seems to you pretty solid so far. You aren't ready to jump on board, but you do want to take another step. You explore it further. Reaction 3. The episodes and perhaps some additional readings and your careful thoughts have convinced you that while we will of course learn more as we go, this vision is the real deal. It answers the question, what do we want, as much as we reasonably can before we fully get there? And now I'm going to hazard some advice. If you have reaction 1, that participatory economics is balderdash. First, as a favor, I wonder if you would let me know why you think that. After all, if you are right, I don't want to spend more time advocating it. And if you are wrong, perhaps you would be open to considering further. But even if you aren't interested in further deliberations, you would then be back to what we do given the rejection of capitalism and existing alternatives, now including this one. Will you drop back into pursuing success or a plateau of minor plenty or even suffering poverty within the confines of the world as we know it? Or will you battle that world and perhaps yourself work on the problem of developing a worthy and viable vision of a better world? Ultimately, while I rarely suggest that one is either a part of the problem or a part of the solution, I think on this issue it applies. If you instead have reaction to, well, that seems very reasonable to me. Wanting an economic vision and hoping participatory economics proves viable is, to my mind, rather like wanting a cure for cancer and hoping that a very serious presentation of one proves viable. If you know it isn't viable, okay. If you don't know it isn't, why wouldn't you hope it is? And then what? Well, in this case, it depends, I think. You may want to invest some time in pursuing the proposed vision more deeply, reading, viewing, talking, debating. Or you may feel that doing that isn't your cup of tea, or that other things you can do would better utilize your talents. There are lots of perfectly reasonable paths. And what about reaction three? Here, too, I think there is a right answer. If you see participatory economics, or any other economic vision you may prefer, as worthy and viable, I think it means if you take your own view seriously, you become a revolutionary, wanting to help attain it. Then what? Well, it again depends. Maybe you are not involved in any activism, perhaps even because you saw no destination for struggle. Okay, you might simply advocate for the vision in the correct belief, I think, that a vision needs widespread support and refinement as well on the road to aiding the path to change. That is one thing I do. Another possibility is you might become involved in economic or social activism in ways taking account of and informed by the vision, or in comparable or better ways that you develop, much as suggested in the last episode. Perhaps the main thing is to be aware of options and self-consciously decide, not least to avoid being carried along, oblivious to, or denying the actual unfolding process. Do you hear of the fraternity's ills and then stay or leave? In my AEPI case, lots of my freshman class left. More, together we became the core of a new campus organization, Rosa Luxemburg SDS, which in the next 3 years turned the campus upside down. Ironically, along the way, a prediction of the AEPI upperclassmen came true. I ran for student body president, and I won. But on an outrageous platform, including no more war research, free tuition for low-income MIT applicants, reparations paid to the Black Panther Party, no more grades, and much more. It turns out that something we all know is true really does matter. Some decisions have long-run ramifications. Can I offer a bit of advice? Don't avoid those decisions. Face them, try to discover the implications, and then choose the path you want to travel rather than being propelled down one or another path by market or peer or role or other pressures. And speaking of choices, how about considering the option to promote and even materially aid Revolution Z? To do so, visit www.patreon.com/revolutionz. It will only take a few minutes. Next vision episode, we will start to address issues of how a worthy future society might handle the core political issues of legislation, adjudication, and collective implementation. Meanwhile, this is Michael Albert, signing off Revolution Z. Until next time.